Hello and welcome to Sipfa Speaks, the podcast for professionals in public finance. Things are ramping up here at Sipfa ahead of our annual conference, our first fully face-to-face event since COVID-19 began. It will be taking place this year from the 7th to 8th of July in London at Westminster's QE2 Centre, and we are incredibly excited. There'll be more information about the programme in the description below, so please do go and check it out. For any students listening, Student Conference is taking place this year on day 2 of the annual conference, so that's the 8th of July, so please do make arrangements to book your tickets if you haven't done so already. So, let's get on to the show. We're talking all things procurement today. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by Leanne Deeming from Blue Light Commercial to discuss procurement in policing, and Fiona Hunt from the Spend Network to discuss their recent report into gender bias in government procurement. But first up is Sipfa's Procurement Network advisor, Mohammed Hans, to talk about the recent procurement green paper. I'm here with Mohammed Hans, who leads Sipfa's Procurement Network. How are you doing today, Mohammed?
Good afternoon, Ashley. I'm fine, thank you.
So thank you very much for joining us today. As I said, Mohammed is the lead for Sipfa's Procurement Network. Would you, for our listeners who aren't kind of practitioners or maybe aren't aware of the network, do you want to maybe tell them a bit more about your role and what the network does?
I've been leading and managing the Sipfa Procurement Commission Network for 16 years. It provides support to practitioners working in local authorities, universities, NHS trusts, every part of the public sector. The whole idea is to try and help practitioners with their busy lives and keep them up to date with new legislation and best practice.
Great, thank you. So, Mohammed has kindly joined us today to talk about the government's recent procurement green paper. So for those of our listeners who aren't procurement practitioners, can you talk them through some of the key proposals that were contained in the paper?
I think the green paper has the ingredients to offer a future transformed procurement environment, one that enables all stakeholders to collaborate, thrive and maximise returns to the UK economy. There are many welcome proposals contained, including simplifying the main procedures to increase flexibility, potentially good news for contracting authorities. As far as I can remember, there have always been commentators and experts and critics who've claimed that public procurement is too bureaucratic. The proposals are to reduce the way we undertake procurement down to 3 procedures from the current 7, placing value for money at the core of decision making. This is especially welcome as the public finances are going to be very constrained for the next several years following the pandemic, making legal challenges or the legal challenge process somewhat quicker and possibly less costly. This is a mixed blessing in my view. Challenges will probably increase in number, but they will be less expensive and less time-consuming to deal with. In recent years, we have seen a huge growth in procurement litigation, which has resulted in some very costly legal cases and failed procurements. There must be a better way to ensure we can balance the interests of suppliers and at the same time ensure vital public sector projects are not delayed due to threat of legal proceedings. Other measures include increases in transparency and promotion of centralized data standards. Again, views are mixed. On the one hand, it will result in increased transparency, which is much needed due to recent revelations. However, not all public contracting authorities will be comfortable with all of this. Indeed, many suppliers might also not be too happy to see that their tender responses and the fact that they've actually not been successful in a tender being published on the website. A centralised or enforced management of exclusion for companies convicted of unethical practices. It will be interesting to see how this actually is delivered in practice. And this could actually end up a very contentious area. Establishment of a centralised procurement watchdog or agency with the power to censure poorly performing procurement teams. Probably negative for local authorities unless the proposal is modified to provide more support and viewability. So there's lots of proposals contained in the green paper.
So you outlined a lot of the opportunities there, so I think we'll kind of skip past going into those in any more details. But in Sipfa's response to the Green Paper, one of the things that was highlighted was a growing skills and resource gap in contracting authorities. What skills do need to be developed in local authorities, and how do you think the Green Paper should be addressing that issue?
Before I address the point about skills development, it must be noted that the number of skilled and experienced staff assigned to work in procurement and commissioning is often limited in many public contracting authorities, and in particular smaller organisations. This will have a material impact on how successfully these proposals are actually delivered on the ground. We therefore need to ensure that teams are resourced, create procurement apprentices who can actually deliver these proposals in the future. Now, referring to the actual skills issue, traditionally there is a limited training on some key elements of the procurement process. The most widely recognised procurement qualification is MSIPS. This actually evolved from a course aimed squarely at private sector supply chain professionals, whose world is very different to the public sector. Offering the workshops offered by the CIPRO Procurement Commission Network cover skills and practices which are essential to effective procurement, yet absent from other training programs in the marketplace. Over the past two decades, a narrow focus on cashable savings has produced diminishing returns as many budgets are pared to the bone before procurement even gets involved. Procurement professionals need a very broad base of commercial skills, but with a public sector ethos that places emphasis on public good and true value for money, not just price cuts. The government appears to recognise this, but they also need to properly resource this. And therefore, as you say, a key recommendation from CIPFA is for the government to set up a capability and skills working group to support the implementation of the Green Paper proposals. And I really do hope that this is actually addressed.
So one of the other points that you touched on when you were talking about the proposals in the Green Paper earlier was around transparency. So CIPRA's response also flagged that the rules relating to conflicts of interest need to be clarified and tightened to combat the growing threat of procurement fraud. There have been a number of stories in the press at the moment around the involvement of elected members in council-owned companies and cronyism in government contracting at the national level. So this does feel like a hugely important issue. How can those rules be tightened, and how do we hold individuals accountable where those rules are being broken?
It's a very good question, actually. As you know, the UK has prided itself on having a reputation as a country that promotes good governance and as a fair place to do business. Suppliers bidding for public sector contracts should be entitled to receive equal treatment to ensure markets are not distorted. And at the end of the day, the hard-working taxpayer does not lose out. The annual public procurement purse is just short about £300 billion. So we're dealing with a huge amount of money, and therefore the propensity of procurement fraud is also very huge. The menace of procurement fraud has been around for many years. And if anybody has any spare time still during the lockdown, as the lockdown eases, I would recommend listeners read up on the Paulson affair in the late 1960s. Procurement irregularities implicated ministers in Ted Heath's government and led to the resignation of the Home Secretary, as well as the jailing of some key politicians in the North East. So procurement does have a bite. Procurement is a very important area. As you alluded, we have tough lessons to learn from the National Audit Office report, in particular into the PPE supply during the pandemic. There is absolutely no excuse for the lack of transparency and not keeping adequate documentation around key decisions, such as why a particular supplier has been given contracts or how the public sector body has identified and managed potential conflicts of interest. As the National Audit Office recommends, public bodies must take a tough approach in managing potential conflicts of interest and bias during the procurement process. At least some basic details of contracts should be published in a timely fashion. There should be no VIP list of suppliers, as that defeats the entire principle of open competition. The auditors should be scrutinising all commercial relationships. Individuals also need to understand that there is a real risk of actual or perceived conflict of interest between their position, either as a practitioner or an elected member, and their private financial interests. There should be a clear and accurate register of interests, and there must be no allowance made for any failure to disclose. Sanctions, including criminal penalties, should follow, as this is fraud at the end of the day.
Great. So that covers up a lot of the areas from CIPFA's response. So responses have now gone into government for the Green Paper. What would you want to see from the government response?
I think a successful outcome of the Green Paper is not just reliant on rewriting the procurement regulations following Brexit, but also investing in and creating a structure, both technologically and organisational, where support bodies are developed and detailed guidance and training is provided to procurement and commission practitioners, as well as judicial reforms. Some of the proposals in the Green Paper are fine and will be helpful, but in some cases, they are just interesting ideas. The actual proposed technical approach will not really be effective. The governments need to reflect on the feedback it receives around framework agreements, remedies and transparency. In particular, there is a commercial skills gap which should only be resolved if the government is willing to commit additional resources in at least the medium term. Otherwise, under-resourced, under-skilled procurement teams will struggle to adapt and will then in turn doubtless be blamed for failing to embed the new policy direction.
What role do you see CIPFA taking in this moving forwards?
CIPFA will take a central role in continuing to raise its voice to protect practitioners in the public sector and hopefully ensure that all proposals, or at least those which are problematic on a day-to-day basis, do not see the light of day. There needs to be greater appreciation, in my view, and allowances made for legislative flexibilities required to commission and procure people-centric services. This could include widening exceptions to offer greater but affordable personalisation and the use of local knowledge in commissioning services. Without this, especially local government organisations and the NHS, will not be able to successfully meet the operational and financial pressures presented by social care demands. It's also very important, and I'm hoping that the government reflects on this particular point, that the new legislation ensures accessibility of procurement opportunities to all types of economic operators, including SMEs, voluntary community sector organizations, and other local community groups. The Green Paper proposals around contract management must also be addressed and reinforced by developing a mandatory qualification to improve commercial skills of procurement staff. Last but very importantly, there must also be a greater appreciation and acknowledgement of the public procurement profession, with better career opportunities and rewards for staff.
Lovely stuff. A lot of things to think about there. So we'll be watching the government with interest for their response. Thank you very much for joining us today, Mohammed. I have no doubt that our listeners will have found that incredibly insightful.
Thank you.
Thanks to Mohammed for joining us this week. Next up, SIPFA's Alison Kroll met with Leanne Deeming to explore procurement issues in policing.
I am Alison Kroll, and I am here with Leanne Deeming from Blue Light Commercial. Thank you for joining us, Leanne.
Thank you.
Could you start by telling us a bit about your organization, Blue Light Commercial, and your role there, as well as a bit about your background?
Yes, thanks, Alison. Hi, my name is Leanne Deeming. I'm the Chief Executive Officer for Blue Light Commercial. I have over 30 years experience both in private and public sector and in both operational transformational roles and also commercial leadership roles. I've been the Chief Executive Officer for Blue Light Commercial for just coming up to a year. It's a really exciting role to set up a new company, which was grant funded by the Home Office for a 3-year period and is owned by the Police and Crime Commissioners for the 43 forces in England and Wales. It came about by a business case, which looked at a case for change, looking at how we can achieve the policing vision 2025 in terms of the procurement aspects and the commercial aspects. It also looked at providing savings targets by looking at aggregation and collaboration, and it also looked at improving the competence and capability and standardisation across the different areas. So the Minister for Crime and Policing announced in January 2020 that Blue Light Commercial will embed and enhance future collaboration, procurement, making best use of policing's buying power, increasing standardisation, improving value for money. Blue Light Commercial will apply strategic procurement approaches to areas such as vehicles, estates, equipment, including uniform, to deliver annual savings of 20 million in commercial efficiencies once it's been fully established, which can be reinvested in the front line. It also recognised that we would look at capability as well and the competence within the policing, both in the commercial activities that are done by procurement people, but also in the ones that are done at the wider sense across policing. That is really, in a nutshell, what Blue Light Commercial as an organisation is about. It is set up as a limited company, which is a not-for-profit, and it has board, which includes 5 police and crime commissioners, 3 chief constables and a non-executive director. And basically, we were incorporated in April 2020 and we went live in the 1st of June 2020 as a company. We very quickly had to build up a team of people which have come from a very diverse background. We've got people from policing, people from public sector, people from private sector, and that has given us, I think, a unique blend of skills of people with all these different capabilities we need to create value creation for policing in both the financial and the non-financial areas.
Okay, great. Thank you. Okay, so let's go into the first question. What do you see as the main procurement challenges in policing?
I think probably it's around 4 words, which is simplification, making it easier for suppliers to do business with us. When the business case was put together for Blue Light Commercial, the landscape is quite fragmented and often difficult for suppliers to know what it is we're trying to achieve. So providing that simplified route into suppliers obviously is an advantage. Standardization would be the next word I would use, and that's really about using best practices, trying to get simplification on the processes for the things we're procuring. You know, things like uniforms would be an obvious one, but also getting the benefits of that standardization. Duplication, so not doing things 43 times, using, where it is appropriate, national frameworks or national procurement strategies to actually drive aggregation of spend, but also around how we can actually contract. Blue Light Commercial has been set up in a way which can assist in that. And I think that's obviously supplementary to the local policing procurement teams as well. And also looking at the full life cycle. So the commercial life cycle is key. So we're often really good at the sourcing part of it, but the pre-procurement part needs a lot of effort to do properly, particularly the market analysis, the market understanding, the options analysis, and building the strategies. So taking a category strategy approach. The last part of the process, which is the post-procurement process, which is all around the contract management and how we actually deal with our suppliers on an ongoing basis once we award contracts.
How can forces balance outcomes and achieving social value locally with the national drive to make savings in procurement?
I think it's all about education and dialogue with the suppliers and the potential suppliers. We've just rolling out a tool which we've done in partnership with Net Positive, and this enables suppliers to think differently about the value they can add. This is a win-win tool. The tool provides them with sustainable development and they can export that to use their business needs and their future work, but it also provides us with rich data to progress. It's aligned to the UN goals, so it allows us to understand the social value for this and enables us to encourage more small and medium enterprises who traditionally may have found it difficult to use the public sector in terms of tendering. This tool produces them a plan which they can then use to actually enable them to assist in their tendering process. But I think the key thing about the social value, about the national versus the local, it's possible with approaches to use a national approach but still have a local presence on it. And I think the tool I'm talking about also allows us to do that. So you can actually see it both at the national level, but you can see it at the individual force level.
Do you think there is a place for a more local approach to procurement?
This is an interesting sort of question. Because, as you know, there are different models you can use for how you do your procurement. And having worked in every single one of those models, I think I can understand the pros and cons of that. And I think it needs to be tailored towards the needs of the environment. So I think if we look at policing as an example here, I think it's appropriate for certain things to be managed locally, because it actually enables good contract management at the local phase. But also some of the processes like purchase to pay process are obviously really important to be managed locally as well. So there needs to be an understanding of what things are best provided for locally and what things are best provided for either regionally or nationally. And I think it's about having that clarity about how we do that. But the key thing is not to duplicate. By giving that transparency in the process of what works well locally and what works well either regionally or nationally, I think it actually gives a much better way of creating strategies where you get standardization where you need that and you actually can aggregate national demand. But it also makes sure that you have very simple processes where things need to be done locally. But contract implementation, you know, that has to be done at the operational level. And I think that's really important. So even when you've got a national framework, it may be there's elements of it that have to be delivered locally. So they're actually delivered at that site. Sometimes it means the end-to-end process is all done locally, but sometimes it might be a national framework, but the delivery of that is local.
Great, thank you. And would you agree that training is an issue when it comes to procurement? Are they recruiting the right people with the right skills? And if not, how do you suggest this be improved?
So the business case for Blue Light Commercial talked a lot around commercial talent, career paths and development and developing to attract future commercial talent and having a commitment to the profession. And part of the purpose of Blue Light Commercial and my role as CEO was to act almost as that functional lead for capability in that area. I think there's a much more broader issue, though, that we need to look at here. When we talk about the word commercial, we find that there are lots of different people in policing or involved in commercial activities. And I think that's the broader thing. So everything from whether you're a CFO to whether you're an operational police officer managing a contract delivery. And I think it's important that at all of those levels, we actually provide an appropriate level of training. What we're trying to develop as part of our development model for training is to make that appropriate at the appropriate level. So we have a rollout of contract management skills at the operational level and really train the trainer and really understanding what good looks like. And then obviously looking at the more senior leadership, understanding the commercial life cycle in more detail, maybe the CFO level, and understand where this is critical in terms of how to make decisions and what things need to be considered either from the procurement regulations or from some of the guidance that needs to be done through, for example, the outsourcing playbook or the construction playbook, and being able to apply those effectively to get value from them. I think what we've got is some really excellent people with excellent professional qualifications and understanding. But what we have across the police forces in general is a mixture. Sometimes there isn't the funding for the training. Sometimes the level or the position may not be appropriate for what needs to be the decisions that need to be made at that area. So part of our role here is to provide that framework so we can actually upskill what we have today, but also create and provide those career paths for the future.
And our last question, do you have any predictions for the future of police procurement as related to changes in working practice, artificial intelligence, Brexit, or any similar issues?
Probably all of those. I think what we're seeing is a changing landscape. We're seeing two things, I think. One is COVID has put us in a position where finances are tighter, so therefore we need to extract more value, which means we need to ensure we can get to things that can be standardised quicker and faster. But I also think it's changed our attitude to work, which has an impact on some of the categories such as estates and others and how we actually manage those going forward. And I think the other thing it sort of has led us to do is to use technology better, and certainly our ability to engage with bigger groups of suppliers and engage in a way which is simpler. We don't need to have those face-to-face conferences all the time. We can actually keep in connection with using the virtual technology. Procurement of the future has got to be good at using those technologies well to get its market intelligence quicker and faster, and obviously enabling the decision-making process and the agility faster. And I think that's where value can be added. And the last thing is really around how we've seen with the different crises, whether it's COVID, whether it's the Suez Canal, whether it's these different things impacting on the supply chain. I think it's important through the risk profiles that we do to make sure that we do have alternatives, and we do make sure that we manage the risk in those supply chains well and understand where those risks are throughout what we do. And I think, you know, the environmental agenda and sustainability is going to hit hard in terms of what we need to do in procurement and how we need to do things different commercially in terms of looking at things like sustainability, the 2030 agenda with electric vehicles and really moving that zero carbon agenda forward. So those are the things, I think, and really analytics, good and solid analytics using real-time data is going to be key to driving those things forward.
Okay, great. So that was our last question. Thanks for your insights on all of those topics. Definitely a lot to think about there. Thank you for joining us again, Leanne.
You've been listening to Sip to Speaks, and that was Leanne Deaning from Blue Light Commercial. Lastly today, we have Fiona Hunt from the Spend Network on gender bias in government procurement.
So today we're joined by Fiona Hunt from the Spend Network. Thanks for joining us today, Fiona.
Thanks for having me.
We're very happy to have you on the episode. Today, we're talking about gender inequality. So let's get this conversation started. First and foremost, do you mind sharing with our listeners a bit about your background and your organization?
At Spend Network, we have a goal to collect and share every public tender and contract in the world and publish that data openly. We have access to procurement data from 150 countries. We try and look at issues that are important, where we can use that data to improve both procurement, but also the overflows of procurement, if you like, around how open data and good procurement makes for sort of better society and makes us make better decisions and those sorts of things.
So you're one of the authors of a report called Procuring Inequality, Understanding the Gender Pay Gap in Government Contracting. What was the spark that made you think this research needs to be done? And can you give us a little bit of an overview of that report?
Well, we know that the gender pay gap has long been an issue. we could see an opportunity to use the data that we have, because we have access to such a breadth of procurement data, and particularly in the UK. I mean, it's important to say that the UK really leads the way in its transparency of data and the amount of data we have. So it allowed us to do this research in the first place, which is important. But we could see an opportunity to use the data to examine the gender pay gap in a way that's never been done before. So nobody's ever looked at the gender pay gap as it relates to government procurement. So we thought, because we know that using data to improve societal or tackle issues that are important was an opportunity for us that we couldn't miss.
Wow. So it really is the first time. It's all other gender pay or gender inequality analysis has all been in-house or inside the government, not actual contracting outside.
Yeah, there's nothing that's looked at both the government in terms of their gender pay data and also significant suppliers to government, which was sort of the key thing that we wanted to look at, was how do government departments fare in their own right, but then equally, how do significant suppliers to government fare with gender pay? And is there a difference between the national average of the gender pay gap and the gender pay gap within both government departments, but then also within significant suppliers? So yeah, first time it's been done, which is great.
And so what were some of the key findings from the report, the headlines?
Yeah, so I guess just to give a bit of a scope of what we looked at to get this data. So we linked the gender pay gap reports from 2,600 organisations within our database of contract data and spend. We looked at around about 31,000 contracts won by these organisations, so government spend won by companies, during the period of 2017 to 2020. So this gave us insight. So it's really interesting, particularly because companies tend to report their gender pay gap statistics annually, and we were able to look longitudinally across 2017 to 2020, which was also something that's not been done before. So this gave us insight into whether public money is, or which public money is going to which organisations, what gender pay exists in those organisations, and the extent of this phenomena across all of public contracting. So in terms of key findings, not surprisingly but disappointingly, the research showed that there is a gender pay gap towards men. I think we're aware of that generally, but certainly there's a gender pay bias towards men in the delivery of public services. And this bias increases once public services are outsourced to the private sector. So to give an example, if you compare the national average gender pay gap for all reporting organisations, which is currently at 11.47% to be precise, suppliers to the public sector actually have a larger pay bias towards men of 12.61%, according to our research. Probably more concerningly than that is if you look again longitudinally, you can see that 92.57%, so nearly all government spend with suppliers between 2017 and 2020, went to companies with a pay bias in favour of men. I guess more concerningly again, 67.65% of that contract value went to firms that pay men more than 10% more than women. So 67.65% of contract value goes to companies that pay are way above the national average. So that was a concern for us. I guess the good news, if there is any, is that public sector organisations generally do better, with an average median pay gap of 9.85%. So some things are better for the government, but definitely more concerning for the significant suppliers to government.
Right. So I mean, 31,000 contracts, my first thought is that's a pretty good sample size to be working with, a pretty good glimpse.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think one thing that Spend Network really prides itself on is good data. We are really robust in our sample sizes. We check, double check, triple check. We have really great processes in place to make sure that the data that we use is right. We have a big team of analysts that really are so thorough and so rigorous. And certainly we wouldn't put a report out like this unless we felt that what we came up with was good data. So, yeah.
And my next question, I think you've actually already answered it, was does it pay to be prejudiced? So does a greater gender pay gap mean you win more or perhaps more lucrative contracts? And it seems like the answer is yes.
Yeah, well, it's interesting because, yeah, the data does say that. But just to contextualize it, correlation doesn't equal causation. where there's a strong link, we can't say that the gender bias is the cause of more success or failure. And very much the different industries play a big role here. So, and the good thing is we have looked at it by industry sector, so it does allow us to see the differences quite clearly. So to give you an example of that, if you looked at business services category, there's a strong negative correlation between a high gender pay gap and the value of contracts earned. So we see that as the gender pay gap increases, the value of contracts that are being won decreases. So that's in that sector, it has a sort of a different set of outcomes. But if you look conversely at the at construction as a sector, the opposite is true. Companies with the highest pay gaps are effectively being rewarded with higher value contracts. It doesn't mean that the gender pay gap is influencing the outcome of tenders by any means. It's not. But if you flip it, the data shows that the gender pay disparity is not impacting suppliers' ability to win business either. So where it's not an influence in winning business, it's not stopping businesses from winning either.
So do you see it as a government responsibility or a responsibility of the suppliers to be tackling this issue?
Yeah, it's a good question. I guess ultimately the responsibility for gender pay sits within the organizations, absolutely. But we were hoping with this report that the government could lean into this data, particularly at the moment where it's reviewing it has this green paper on public procurement. And we think there's an opportunity for them to monitor and evaluate this data and look at how it might be used to improve procurement processes going forward. I mean, the good thing is, as I said at the beginning, the UK government is a leader in the field of data and transparency compared to globally. We look at government data from 150 countries. So comparatively, the UK is in a pretty good place. There's still room to improve, but it's doing okay. We think there's a further opportunity, I guess, to be even better, to really take the opportunity to do something that no one else is doing and roll this into their procurement processes. So we've put together in the report, I think it's 6 recommendations of what we would suggest they could do, including things like making gender pay disparity data a part of the supplier registration process. When companies go to register to win contracts from government, they could also include gender profiling in beneficial ownership data. And obviously, of course, as we always suggest, is just sharing more data, being more transparent, putting as much data as possible available for public scrutiny.
The big question, what are you going to be doing with the findings going forward?
Well, because it's the first time that this has been done, and certainly the first time we've looked at it, we would love to continue to look at this into the future. So definitely we will be doing a year-on-year review. We might look at extending the parameters. Look, as we said, we've looked at 2017 to 2020. There may be an opportunity to look more widely. We would love to be able to expand the countries that we look at this issue with. So again, the UK is great because it's allowed us to do that, because we do have the access to data and many countries just don't have that data available. But we would love to be able to explore it with other countries and help governments tackle this inequality by using this this great data that's available to them.
Yeah, it is really fascinating research, and it seems like just incredible amount of opportunity for development as well.
Yeah, we think so. We think it could be, you know, it's there to use. We've done the work. It would be great to see governments use it for making procurement better and ultimately make society better.
And hopefully they do.
Hopefully they do.
And that's all we have time for today, Fiona. Thanks so much for your time.
Oh, thanks so much.
Really interesting stuff. Thank you, Fiona. And thanks again to all of our speakers for joining us this week. That's all we've got time for, and we'll see you again next time.